Welcome back, Into the Void listeners. I'm your host, Scott Fardella. It's another beautiful, sunny Friday here in Kingston. Before I introduce today's guest, I want everyone to pause this episode and visit Feet Socks. Click the link in my bio on Instagram at Scott Fardella or at Into the Void Podcast to instantly receive $20 off your purchase on checkout. They have lots of unique styles, including no-show socks and dress socks. Plus, they now have swimwear and hoodies. My brother's wedding is coming up in September, and I will be wearing feet on my feet. Use my link, save some money, get a box of socks. Oh, just one quick note about the sound quality. Unfortunately, for this episode, we had to go with Facebook, and as we have experienced in the past, because of lag issues, it cuts out a little bit. I did my best to clean it up, but hopefully it's still listenable. My guest today is Jillian Cameron. Among other things, Jillian is a belly dancer, part of the Kingston Belly Dancing Collective. Belly dancing is a really body-positive form of dance that gained prominence in the West after the Chicago World's Fair at the turn of the century. I wanted to talk to Jillian about how she got into dancing, the culture surrounding the activity, and to help promote their show at Spearhead Brewing Company here in Kingston in September. So without further ado, here is Jillian Cameron. And we're live. Good morning.
Hi. Can we do the South Park greeting? I miss it.
Good morning, my friends.
Nostalgia.
There it is. That's hilarious. I haven't done that in a while. Let me do that with my own cats.
Treat your coworkers that way anymore?
I should start walking into the dealership like that. That'd be hilarious.
Pet all the cars, say good morning, friends.
Be out there for a while. It's like 1,000 cars out on that lot. So, you are promoting a belly dancing show at Spearhead Brewing Company here in Kingston. That's in.
I've been to Spearhead before. They have their four basic brews that they always have on hand. One of them is a Moroccan ale.
Yeah, the Moroccan brown, right?
Yeah, Moroccan brown. It's sort of an acquired taste. You either are going to love it or hate it. Mm-hmm. I bought it the first time because it has a belly dancer on the can.
Right.
Like, oh my God, my beer, I must have this. And then I liked it. And I debated for months asking the manager if we could do some kind of event there to promote it. But I have some anxiety issues, so that was difficult. But, you know, with a couple of them inside my stomach and filtering into my bloodstream, got the Dutch courage, as you call it.
The Dutch courage. I've never heard it referred to as that.
Got the sentence out of my mouth before she went, oh my God, yes, that would be great.
See? Wow. Shoot your shot.
This is going to be good.
Yeah.
So what actually ended up happening is they don't really like the design on the can, so they are changing it, and they were just going to switch it over one day, but they decided with us on board, they're going to have a retirement party for her.
So they're still selling Moroccan brown. They're just retiring that design.
Yeah. Oh, so September 29th, which is a Saturday night, doors will open at 6:30 and the show will start at 7.
Okay.
There will be three sets of different styles of belly dance because the Kingston Belly Dance Collective is not one troupe. It's multiple groups that work together. And I'm sorry. There will be a three-course Middle Eastern meal catered by Capers of Kingston.
Nice.
Two half pints of beer, so you don't have to have the Moroccan. You can have whatever flavor you would prefer.
Okay.
So if you don't, then why would you come to a Moroccan night?
So for people who are unfamiliar with Middle Eastern cuisine, what would that dinner entail? What would that involve?
There will be an appetizer, an entree, and a dessert, all of Moroccan variety.
Hmm.
So at 7 o'clock, we'll do a set, and then they'll serve the appetizer course. At 8 o'clock, we do a set. The entree will come out. 9 o'clock, a set, and then dessert.
What type of food could people expect, though? Like lamb, or? So,
by what I know about Moroccan food, it will be probably vegetarian, but I'm not 100% sure on that yet, because they haven't completely nailed down what they're going to be serving.
Ah. Well, that would be nice, though.
An interesting way for people to experiment with that food.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it sounds like a fun night.
Also get a take-home commemorative can with the original dancer on the can.
Cool.
10 o'clock, the most exciting part will be Halima, who's one of Kingston's better dancers, and you know her as the Black Cat Bakery lady.
Okay, Christine, yeah.
So after you've been in the tap room all night and had your two free beer and however many more you'd like to consume, get on up and learn how to belly dance with Halima.
Really? Wow, cool. And how much does this whole experience cost?
It will be $55 a ticket. Okay. And tickets will be on sale through Eventbrite starting sometime next week.
Okay. So again, that includes your full three-course dinner, the show, and then you can learn how to belly dance afterwards if you're interested.
Beer to drink there and one can to take home.
Nice. That's a pretty good deal. Jeez.
Yeah, like if you figure you're going to go out for a three-course dinner with two drinks each, you're probably going to drop more
easily
than $55
yeah,
a person.
Yeah, easily more than that. That's awesome.
And the live show.
Yeah.
And there's so many different styles of belly dance. So with the collective, you get to explore all of what we have to offer. And if it's something you're interested in taking classes with, we can hook you up with the right dancer.
Hmm.
So there's traditional Egyptian, some fusion dance, American tribal style, which will have swords, which should be kind of exciting
for
people. Cool. Super sharp, but they are sharp enough.
That sounds
and
fun.
It's something new that we haven't seen before called Egyptian street dancing that one of our members has taken a liking to. That's sort of how, if you look at a North American audience and dance, how certain dances evolved into break dance and things like that. This is how Egyptian dance has morphed into something that the kids are doing outside for fun.
That's cool.
So she thought that would be good to bring in and show people too. So we'll be well-rounded. There'll be a couple of fusion pieces. And when you journey into the world of fusion, there really are no rules. Anything goes.
And like,
there will be a Spanish fusion. And I'm doing belly dance to some Hugh Laurie music of all things.
Nice. Is there...
Duncan showed me songs because I liked House. And the next thing I knew, I was kind of dancing around to it, and it's turned into a choreography.
Is there a large community of belly dancers in Kingston?
Not huge. Belly dance is something that sort of goes in waves. It's very popular for a while, thanks to Shakira. We really
I was going to say, yeah, that
and
late night.
Off, and then it comes back, and it fades off. So there are three women in town who teach, and they have decent class size numbers, but it's not what it was 10 years ago.
And is it, I imagine any form of dance is good for fitness, but is it particularly good for any type of fitness for belly dancing? Like, obviously your cardio, I imagine.
It's good for cardio and muscle tone because you're working one set of muscles at a time. They call it isolation, so
right,
that you get sharp tick, tick, tick moves that you're used to seeing.
Okay.
But you can modify things to suit your body. There's certain moves that maybe you can't do. Your instructor will show you how to do it so that it works for you. It's going to look a little different, but it's something that you can then have ability to do. And if your legs aren't great, you can focus mainly on arm movements. I've seen wheelchair belly dancers on YouTube.
Nice.
That are fantastic.
That's awesome.
Just all upper arm and veil movements, because you get a big 1.5 meter by 3/4 of a meter piece of silk that you're working with, that works quite well in a wheelchair. So there's, you're limited by what you think you're limited to.
So it's very, very body positive, very inclusive type of dance.
First class I went to, I think like 9 or 10 years ago, the first thing the instructor said is there's no wrong body type. And in a Middle Eastern culture, the larger dancers are the ones that people want to see. And if you're doing a shimmy, it reverberates through your whole body. If you don't have any moves, something's missing.
Yeah.
Kind of, that was an eye-opener that I don't have to be a super tiny, skinny little twig to do this dance. I can be whatever I need to be. I've had two kids, so I have the little muffin top going on.
I'm sure Duncan's going to appreciate you talking about your muffin top. That's hilarious.
At one point it was quasi cool, And then when puberty hit, he didn't want to, no one must know. And now he's just embarrassed by it because I'm his mom. I should.
Yeah, I can't
that.
Wait for him to hear this.
And like, just get over it. It's fine. My daughter's okay with it. She's come to a few classes. It's not for her, but
no. I'm not sure if it would be for me either. Do you get many guys?
Very few.
Yeah, I would imagine.
The upper world of professional dancers, men aren't taken as seriously, which is. There are a few fantastic male dancers out there. Like, if anyone's on YouTube and wants to check it out, Tito Seif, mm-hmm. S-I-E-F, and Tito, like Tito Jackson, he's a fantastic dancer. But for the most part, it's a dominated art form.
Yeah. I would think just the shape of the female body probably lends itself more towards this. Men's bodies are too boxy, you know?
Yeah. The men's costumes basically are not that attractive, and they're not glittery. When you buy your first belly dance costume and it's completely bejeweled, and there's just something about that, and you don't get that in the men's costumes. And it picks up the light, it reflects, it's pretty.
I have a preconceived notion in my head what a men's belly dancing costume would look like, and I'm basically picturing Aladdin. Is that at all accurate?
Some of them, or basically a long nightshirt.
Ah, okay, well. That couldn't be less flattering.
Better. And when I bought my first one that was totally bejeweled, the first thing I did was like knocked on my boobs and went like, I could stop a bullet with this thing. This is fantastic.
Before we started recording, we were talking about how unfortunately belly dancing gets like sexualized, and the preconceived notion, I guess, is that belly dancers are strippers.
Yes,
you guys dealt with
we
that?
Fight against that all the time. Even people I know what I do, know what my personality is. They'll be like, oh, old, do you want to go belly dance on that? I don't use
pole. Yeah, pole dancing is not a part of belly dancing.
Bra top, your abdomen is exposed, you're doing what's called a belly roll or an undulation where a muscle wave goes through your belly from top to bottom or bottom to top. It does look a little sexualized, even though it's not. So the perception is there that we're just a bunch of strippers, and why didn't you take off your clothes?
So to clarify, there'll be no stripping at the event in September, just
and
in case anyone was unclear about that.
Policy.
Yes.
People are on cameras and take pictures if they want, but you must not touch the dancer.
And
it's just
that's
not
fair.
That though.
If you're going to this event expecting to touch the dancers, ball your fist up and punch yourself in the face.
Yeah. And some of the dancers will be working their way into the crowd where they dance. I won't be because I don't trust what my reaction might be if someone were to actually touch me. I'd probably punch them. And that's not choreographed into my number, and I don't know how I'd recover from that.
That upsets me that somebody would go...
Don't come in my bubble unless you're invited in my bubble.
It upsets me to think that people would go to like a fairly friendly event like that with such a body positive style of dance and then grab a dancer.
Yeah.
Like
it hasn't happened to me, but I've heard stories from other women that, and it's very upsetting even when they handle it with grace and dignity on stage.
Yeah.
That setting, and you wouldn't go to a ballet show and grab the dancers. So
well, you wouldn't even
do
it at
a
strip club,
either.
For God's sakes. Like, you'd still get bounced at a strip club for just grabbing the stripper.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah, and we're somebody's mom, we're somebody's kid, we're sometimes somebody's wife or partner. Like, we're human beings. We should be treated with respect for our art. There's a lot of work that goes into creating a choreography.
Yeah.
And when you interfere with it, it's sometimes hard to get back on track.
Yeah, for sure. So settle down there, boys.
It's just a respect thing. Like,
absolutely.
Leave me alone because my stomach is exposed. And mean, like, if you wouldn't go to the beach and start hitting people, don't do it at a belly dance show.
So it was popularized in the West at the Chicago World's Fair at the turn of the century. I think it was like 1893 or 1897. Chicago World's Fair happened.
Theories, multiple theories. That's the one that I was taught.
Mm-hmm.
And the history check does fact out that this was there. There was a Tunisian pavilion with a dancer called Little Egypt.
Yeah.
Showed her abdomen. And this was a time when piano legs had to be covered because they would make people think dirty sexual thoughts.
That's true, though.
And here's this woman dancing with her stomach exposed, and P.T. Barnum was there, and he noticed that men were paying their money, going through, coming out, and getting right back in line again. So he got some women to learn it and put them in his circus.
Belly
dancing came to North America.
Those turn-of-the-century men were thirsty.
Yes, I think so. But, you know, when you can't even look at a piano, whereas you see pictures on Facebook with a shoe, and it's like, ooh, dat ankle.
Damn ankles, though.
And then Hollywood got a hold of it, and it was prominent in a lot of silent films. Bolton's Tent and The Harem. And again, that's not what we are, but that's what Hollywood perception was.
Yeah, yeah, back in the day, I remember seeing... I mean, I was born in the 80s, but I remember watching, I feel like old Westerns and like spaghetti Westerns, and then just old movies in general. Anytime they'd show Egyptians, it's always belly dancing. It's always, yeah, the harems and the glittery costumes, but it's always sexualized in that sense.
With the Andorian slave girl dancers, they're basically belly dancers.
In which, sorry?
In Star Trek.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, there is a dance troupe that you can find at Comic-Con that they paint themselves green and they do that.
I mean, I feel like even Star Wars with the Twi'leks in what was it? In A New Hope, in the very first Star Wars. When they go into the bar in Mos Eisley, there's dancers there, I'm fairly sure. They might have been added later, but...
Her outfit was somewhat reminiscent of a dance costume too. Yeah. And again, it was sexualized.
Yeah, Princess Leia in the gold bikini. Yeah. I got pretty excited when you started talking about the Chicago World's Fair. I am a depth of knowledge about the Chicago World's Fair. Just useless factoids about it. As I read one book one time, and it's actually really interesting, that fair. If you're not familiar with it, there's a great book called In the White City, and it's about the Chicago World's Fair and also H.H. Holmes, who was America's first known serial killer, who was active in Chicago at the time that the Chicago World's Fair was being built and was happening. And I'm sure people are familiar with him. He was, if you've seen like American Horror Story, he was the guy in Hotel. He was one of the characters in that. But he's also, he built the hotel in Chicago that was like a whole city block. And it was like a scene from Saw. Like it had rooms that were just soundproof and screamproof. And he had vents that would pump in smoke or vapor that would knock out his victims. So it would be like chloroform. He had chutes for bodies that he could just dump them in the chute and they would take them to the basement, and like a vault that would suffocate them. Like it was just a fun house of murder. It's insane. And they burnt it down. They burnt down the hotel not long after he, I believe, was executed. But he I think, was accused of killing upwards of like 200 people.
There is a movie, I think, on Netflix about him. The name of it is gone. Right now.
They were supposed to be making The Devil in the White City as a movie with Martin Scorsese and Leo DiCaprio as H.H. Holmes. Because he was apparently described as like, he had really steel blue eyes, like a really handsome, charismatic, attractive guy. And he was a doctor. He was a legit doctor. But he was just a monster, just an absolute monster. And didn't discriminate. It was young, old, women, men, children. Everything. But besides that, at the World's Fair at the time, it kind of revolutionized a lot of different things. Like, I think electric light was scaled down so that it could be used for personal use. Like, they had to figure out a way to basically build a city within a city. And Walt Disney's father also worked in the construction of that, and Walt Disney would visit him, and that's where he got the idea to build a city within a city. So I found that really fascinating. It's also around the time that like Jack the Ripper was active in London, and then what else was happening at the time? The launching of the Titanic, the sinking of the Titanic was happening at the same time. So there was all these crazy, interesting world events, like the fire departments kind of honed their techniques because of this place, because they needed their own fire brigade to police and what's the cordon off this whole area, this whole city, because it was just a fire trap, like it was a tinderbox just waiting to go up. So there were so many like just plywood buildings, I guess, that were constructed, so they had to have fire brigades there. And what else was there? Just so many interesting little inventions that came about because of the Chicago World's Fair. It was very cool.
I don't know if it's true or not, but that's where the ice cream cone came from.
Might have been. I don't remember that.
Because they ran out of bowls and the waffle maker was next door.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Waffle maker to roll a waffle for him, and the ice cream cone was born. But I got nothing to back that up as fact.
No, you're probably right. There was a number of neat little things like that. And I don't know. Read that book, The Devil in the White City. It's very fascinating, and it's a true crime book. So, you know, kind of best of both worlds. And the scale of it is unimaginable. Like, it has pictures in the book, but the Americans did that because the World's Fair in France erected the Eiffel Tower. So that's where the Eiffel Tower came from, and the Americans wanted to do something that would top that, so they held the Chicago World's Fair, which in retrospect, they're just tremendous wastes of money. Like, they're huge, huge wastes of money. That's why they don't do them anymore. It's like building an Olympic Village, which, you know, arguably is a huge waste of money, but that's essentially what it is, except bigger. Like, it's I can't even give you the dimensions, but when you see the photos, I was like, holy shit, that's huge. It's bigger than Kingston, you know? I was playing pretty fast and loose with the facts there, so I thought I would correct myself. I researched it, and the Chicago World's Fair was approximately 3 square kilometers, so not quite the same size as Kingston. I think Kingston's like 1,900 square kilometers, but anyway, it was big, all right? Look it up. It's crazy. And the inventions that came out of it were, there were many, but Juicy Fruit Gum, Pabst Blue Ribbon, Aunt Jemima's Pancake Mix, Squash Pennies, Spray Paint, Dishwashers, and the Ferris Wheel, including several others. So do yourself a favor. If you like true crime, read The Devil in the White City. And now back to our regularly scheduled program, the podcast.
For like a month? Couple of weeks?
Yeah, for I think it was on for like 2 months maybe, but not very long, or maybe it was longer than that, but it's not like, it's not meant to be permanent is the point, and then they just tear it down.
Yeah.
And then a couple things remain, like the Eiffel Tower stayed, and that's when the Ferris Wheel, that's what it was. They wanted a structure that would rival the Eiffel Tower, so I think his name is George Ferris or John Ferris. Presented them with this idea of this giant rotating wheel, and they had the Ferris wheel there. And that was, I think, the world's first and largest Ferris wheel at the time.
Those things creep me out.
They creep you out?
Oh, I can't stand them. I feel so unsafe on one of them, especially when you're stuck with someone who rocks the chair back and forth when you're at the top.
Yeah, and then it just stops at the top. Neat view, but I don't know. Not necessarily for me. I've seen that movie Final Destination. I know how this ends.
Exactly. It's just like that big wheel in London. I have no desire to go on that. That's just way too high.
The Eye of London. They're pretty neat.
Not for me.
So what else besides belly dancing, what are you doing now?
I am getting prepped for back to work in September.
And tell the people what you do.
I am a partial load professor at St. Lawrence College in the vet assistant program, and I've spent most of the summer rewriting one of my lab manuals from scratch, so basically the entire course had to be reworked, and Good thing I don't have much going on in the summer, because that's been a full-time job.
I was going to say, that sounds like a fair amount of work.
Yep, but rewarding and necessary, because when you teach in an industry that's constantly evolving, your subject matter has to evolve too if you want your graduates to be able to fit into the workforce when they get out.
Right, yeah, and I don't think that's something enough industries do. Like, they don't stay up to date, and it's difficult because it's getting easier because we're more and more in the digital age, but say they'll print a manual. And that's why we pay so much for textbooks, because they'll print a manual and a year later, the information updates so rapidly. That's why I've always said, and they'll never ever do this because textbooks are an industry, but what they should do at the beginning of college, at the beginning of university, is issue everybody like a kudo, or not a kudo, what's it called? Kobo. A Kindle reader, like an e-reader, basically.
We try to have manuals that are printed in the bookstore as much as possible, because then we can update and edit. And then it's cheaper, too, because my manual will probably clock in about $15 in the bookstore.
Yeah, whereas to buy a brand new textbook, you're looking at between $65 and $200, depending.
Yeah, the book I use for my medical terminology class is over $100.
Yeah.
But definitions don't change, so that's a book you can have forever and continue use. So I don't mind that one so much, but anytime you can keep your costs down for your students, it's just better off, because school costs a lot of money.
School does cost a lot of money. It is outrageous nowadays. I was reading, or I saw a video the other day that was saying in the United States, at least, I imagine Canada's not far off, but household debt for the average young person now, it's like 40% of that is student debt. And it'll take on average 20 years to pay off their student loans.
Basically a mortgage that you sign on for.
For life, and you can't default on it, which is such a scary prospect. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but I used to tell everybody at the cafe when they would come in, like young people, if you have any inkling to go into business for yourself, and you're not sure what you want to do as far as school, go into business for yourself, or take out a loan and try your own way if you have the ambition to do that, because you can at least like go bankrupt on that. If it doesn't work out, like at least you tried it and it didn't work, you'll get valuable experience out of it. But then you can at least start over at some point if it doesn't work. I mean, that's probably bad advice to just give you to go into it. Obviously, do your research and make sure you're not throwing your money down a toilet. But I mean, you might be doing the same thing anyway if you don't know what you're doing for school and you sign on and then you decide in a year that you don't want to do it anymore, but now you've invested even $15,000 that you have to pay back. There's no way to ever get out of that. You can go bankrupt and you'll still have to pay that. It's an insane proposition.
They're of high school, because kids, some of them know exactly what they want, but them aren't really sure.
Yeah.
And they're being, you have to pick what you want to do with your life, and they're going into programs that maybe they shouldn't be in, and it's costing money.
Yeah, it's bizarre to me that we're saddling 18, 19 year olds with that proposition. Like, if you sat them down and gave it to them honestly and said, here's a $65,000 business loan, I know you have no fucking clue what you want to do yet for the rest of your life because you're 19, but here's $65,000. Good luck.
Yeah.
Like, what? You would never do that if it was business. Like, do you know how hard I had to, like, how many hoops I had to jump through to get a business loan? And yet you can get OSAP and just good luck, here you go. Like, that's an industry, that's predatory to pick on students like that, young people, and to funnel them into that system, I think, is irresponsible too, because a lot of people, myself included, had no idea the direction there. And not only that, but like my life direction has taken, you know, several sharp turns in different, right? As everyone's probably has or will. So why are we in such a rush to funnel them through this system where you're getting saddled with debt that makes it unfeasible to do anything else? Don't go to school.
You don't always know articulate what you want when you're a teenager either. And Eden will laugh at me sometimes because it's like my big regret. I was born in the 60s, so I graduated high school in the 80s. The year I was in grade 11 was when the Atlanta child murderer was found through criminal profiling. It was the first ever profiling thing. And I was so fascinated by that, and I wanted to learn, and I wanted to be a criminal profiler, I guess like Criminal Minds now. I could not go into the guidance office and say that because I thought I'd end up in therapy. Because what is a 16, 17-year-old girl doing saying she's fascinated by the mind of a serial killer? So I just kept my mouth shut. I had a part-time job in a vet clinic. I gravitated towards the vet tech industry because I thought that was the path I was supposed to follow. And I don't regret it. I love what I do. I loved working in the clinics before I left to become a teacher. But that wasn't what my plan was supposed to be when I was a teenager.
Yeah. Well, and who knows if even that would have changed, right? Like,
yeah.
Because you're 16 or you're 17 or whatever. I mean, in 3 years, I mean, when I think back to how much my life has changed since I was 16, Jesus Christ. Like, I should never have been trusted to make that decision for the rest of my life. And it just seems so irresponsible for... Because that's the other thing, is that at 16, you're not as confident as you otherwise will be once you have lived a little bit and you've found your way and you know what you want out of life. You'll listen to adults and your guidance counselor, and you'll say, you know, I want to get into art. And they'll be like, no, come on, that's not what you want to do. You want to do this. This is a smarter choice for you. It's more jobs in this field or whatever. And they'll guide you in a direction that you aren't necessarily interested in. And then because they're an authority figure, or even your parents, same thing. They're like, no, come on, you want to do this. That's the smarter thing. That's the more stable thing. Like, I can't count the number of people when we got into corrections. They asked us on, you know, the first week, how many of you are here just because this is a career? And like probably 2/3 of the class raised their hands just because they thought it was a stable career. And when you're talking about getting into a prison with prisoners, you know, that's a toxic environment. You're going to burn out in 5 years if you're just doing it for the money. Like, it's such a poor choice. It's a poor decision to go after it like that. Seems like a poor investment.
I wish you could just go back and talk to your 16-year-old self.
I wouldn't have listened.
Don't know anything, shut up.
Yeah, I wouldn't have listened, you know? And I think that's the problem. You can't expect 16-year-olds to listen. You can't expect them to be responsible because they're 16. They're not supposed to be. They don't know.
No, so, they have no... aren't done growing yet.
No, and I think the responsible thing is to kind of... Some of them, there are outliers that absolutely know what they want to do, and, you know, we should support them going that way. But... if kids are unsure, then we should support them in that direction and be like, okay, well, take a few years and work and figure out what you want to do and continue to support them. And not obviously that's not on the schools to do, but maybe there needs to be an infrastructure for that, for the number of kids that aren't going to make a decision on the spot and figure it out. Because there's a lot of kids that would benefit from just traveling for a little bit. I did. And a lot of kids that would benefit from just getting some life experience and like going and renting a house or renting an apartment for a couple of years and working for a couple of years at some shitty job, that after that experience, they'd be like, okay, I know I don't want that. So, you know,
I found when I was in third year, I had a part-time job at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. That was probably the best thing I learned the entire third year of school was, don't end up in a job you hate.
Yeah.
There were people who worked there that loved it and thought it was great, because if you were there full time, you got some benefits. Your raises were good and regular.
But it's not for everybody.
There were people there who just hated their entire existence.
Yep.
I be someone who, when my alarm goes off in the mornings, I think, fuck, I have to go to work.
After the cafe closed, I did that where I've never been a lazy person, so I was applying at jobs absolutely everywhere, minimum wage included. And I worked front desk for about a week and a half at a small motel. And you know what? It was a job, and it's not a bad job. It's just not for me. But yeah. The individuals that I worked with were great. But I remember sitting there thinking, like, this is just, it's not challenging. It's not, it's just not for me. Like, I needed something more. And I knew that I would never be happy at a place like that. Because it just, they could probably pay me all the money in the world, and I don't think I would be happy at a job like that, because it's just not stimulating enough for me. The other guys that were there loved it.
If that's what they like, have at it.
Yeah, exactly. Do
all the jobs.
Yeah.
And if you get satisfaction out of it, great.
Yeah, you know what? People think I'm crazy, but when I was leaving the cafe, I was saying I was hoping that I could get in at the Limestone District School Board as like a custodian. That would be a perfect job for me, because you just go in, you put your headphones in, you clean, you go home. No responsibilities. Yeah. So for me, after the cafe, after having worked really hard for 2 years, I wanted at that time no responsibility. I just wanted something easy that I could put my headphones in, do my own thing, wouldn't have to answer to anybody, and just, you know, relax for a bit. And that would have been great for me. For a lot of people, it's, you know, you'd look at that and be like, ugh, custodian, no thank you. But fuck, that'd be sick for me. I would love it.
It's all what you need at the time.
Yeah, exactly. And that changes. And I remember reading an article saying that for our generation, for my generation and younger people, we are going to have probably 2 or 3 or 4 different careers in our lifetime. Because that seems to be the trend, that you'll work for 5 or 6 years for the same place and then take a year off to travel, and then you'll start a different career, or even at the same career, and then take a few years or work for a few years and then take another year off and travel. And they're not going to have just one steady career for 40 years like our parents did. I think
you got your job, you retired from that job.
Yeah. Like that era is gone. You don't get a job that you just stay at for 40 years. And it's partly the mentality of this generation, but it's also on the employers as well, because it's harder to get full-time permanent status, because then they got to pay you benefits and they got to pay you an increasing salary and everything else. So you see a lot more contract work, a lot less raises for just in general. Like, you don't see that sliding upward scale. Like, you work here for 5 years, here's your raise.
Like, the best boss I ever had was at Bay Ridge Animal Hospital when Jay Black was the owner. Because he thought his best piece of equipment that his clinic had were the people that worked there. And you maintain your equipment so that it always works. So we were treated well. And of his shift, before he'd go home, he'd find everybody and thank them for coming in today. I'm like, you're paying me, you don't need to thank me. And at first I thought, this is just his way of welcoming me. I'm like, no, this is how he is.
That's great. I tried to do that too. And that's why I really like working at Petrie. The team environment that's there, it's fantastic. Like, everybody's really supportive. The management is really appreciative, and they show it every single day. They thank everybody for coming in and doing a great job. If there's anything we need help with, they're right on it. Like, it's a really supportive work environment. And I tried to cultivate that too at the cafe, because especially as a small business owner, you do appreciate when your employees show up. Like, it makes a difference. And I tried to express that every shift that they worked, because, man, having somebody unreliable is the worst.
Well, then you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
As an employer, it costs you nothing to simply say thank you.
Yeah.
Like, free words, and people don't use them enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was always a big thing for me, too, in other positions, in other jobs that I've had. Just being thanked or being recognized for not necessarily going above and beyond, but just like, hey, man, thanks for coming to work. Just thanks for doing your job. Is really all it took for me. And maybe that's something that people listening are probably thinking, well, you shouldn't need to be thanked for just doing your job. But it's, I don't know, just feeling like you're a person is, there's something to be said for that, and not just a fucking number.
Wants that they're valued.
Yeah. If you're going to be there, you're spending as much time at work or more than you are at any other point in your life. You know, you're doing that 40 hours a week. You're spending more time at work than you are with your family in a lot of cases. You want to at least feel like a person, like you're valued. So if you're in upper management, just keep that in mind and like thank your employees and go out of your way, because it goes a long way. Makes a big difference.
Yeah, it just, or something simple, like one of the other vets he employed, they would work every other Saturday. On his Saturdays, he would stop at Tim Hortons on his way in and bring us a breakfast sandwich.
Nice. Yeah, see, that's...
it's just, you spent $2.99 on me, but you made me smile when you came in and you gave me some food. Because I feel like you went out of your way to go and do that. Like, yeah, you bought your own coffee, but you didn't have to add on to your order.
Mm-hmm.
But you did for everybody who's working that shift.
That's something that they do at Petrie. We every Saturday. So I'm working tomorrow. And so if you need a car, come on out and see me. But every Saturday, they order food for us. And we don't pay for it. But for the entire staff that's working on a Saturday, Steve orders food for everybody that's working. And that's a lot of people. There's, you know, 40 people that work there, if not more. So we get every department orders, you know, Copper Penny or wherever. Every single Saturday. That's a huge chunk of change.
I run a Facebook group for jobs for our graduates, because we would get employers contacting the college and saying, who can you send me? And it got very confusing to keep track of where's this grad living? Where do they, because we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But we just make a group and we post these jobs as they come in. And I just posted one for a dog rescue up in King's City, which I think is on the 400 between Toronto and Barrie. Not really sure. But one of their benefits was pizza Saturday, vegan if you need it, we will provide. I'm like, that's really nice.
That's sweet, yeah. Yeah, that is nice.
It's just a tiny little, it doesn't cost you that much.
No. Well, not in terms of the team building, the morale that it builds,
exactly.
Everything. And the it's good. And I was thinking, like, the only drawback I can see from those types of things is you can't stop doing them once you start.
Yes.
Because if there's anything I know about psychology, you can always add things. You can't take them away once people have them. That leaves a really salty taste in someone's mouth to take a benefit away. So that's hard. I remember at the casino, they crushed morale one year. So it was probably around, I don't know, it was when I first started, maybe 2 years in. And they had been, every Christmas, they would give us just a tiny little Christmas bonus. It was Cineplex tickets, like just movie tickets for every employee. You'd get like basically $20 worth of movie tickets. And they would give that to every employee at Christmas time. So pretty substantial amount of money for 200 employees that work there. And they took it away, which to the individual, I get for them, that's a huge chunk of money. To the individual, it's, you know, it seems very petty, because it's only $20. But it, I mean, so damaging for morale to take that away at Christmas time. And I don't know, just seemed very petty. And again, I get it from a business perspective. It's a huge savings right there, but still shitty thing to do.
Yeah. It's an investment in your staff.
It is. And as I said, it's a team building thing. It's a morale booster. It's, you know, it cuts into your profit a little bit, but how much are happy employees worth to you?
Yeah, if you lose your employees, you're constantly having to pay to train someone new.
Mm-hmm. And
you're just waiting for them to jump ship for a better offer.
Yeah, it just makes more sense to invest in the ones you have if they're doing a good job. Correct what you can correct and build on the foundation rather than... Because loyalty, God, that's something to be said for loyalty too. Like a loyal employee that is not only good at their job, but also speaks highly of the place elsewhere once they're off the clock is so valuable.
Yes. Because like working in the vet industry, I go out, you're going to get asked for advice.
Yep.
It's an idiot because like reliable for what we say. So, and I'm not looking at your dog. I can't tell what's wrong with your dog based on what you're just telling me. So I really don't want to put licenses on the line for that. But you'll get people saying, well, where should I go?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a clinic that I work at anymore.
I always send people to Limestone or Kingston West.
Yeah, I love them.
Mm-hmm.
But there are clinics, I won't name them, that I would not go to.
I agree. There are clinics that I can think of that I won't name either. But
because I don't want to steer people, but I would never take my pet there.
Exactly. And that's what I tell people. I always take my pet to Kingston West. I mean, I have friends that work there, so that helps, but I also, I trust them. I put Raja down at that clinic and they're really, humane and compassionate and everything else. So, you know, they'll get my business probably for the rest of my life because of that, because they've treated me really well. So yeah, it's the difference. And they all seem really happy with working there and seems like a good environment.
Quite happy with their job.
What's that?
Meg seems quite happy with her job.
Yeah, yeah. There's good people that work there, good administration, and they seem to do, like, talk about morale-boosting stuff. They do, I think, pub night every first Friday of the month or last Friday of the month, something like that, and they do staff outings, and that's awesome. Like, it's great that they can do that for their staff. I would love to work at a place like that. Not that I don't, because I know Petrie does, but yeah.
And at the beginning, everybody on staff was fitness minded.
Mm-hmm.
So we had corporate at the Y.
Oh, sweet.
They didn't pay, but they got us the ability to get our memberships cheaper so that we would go to aerobics class together. We'd have squash nights. And then as people left and new people came in who didn't want to do that kind of stuff, we lost the numbers to maintain the cheap membership.
Mm.
So it sort of dropped. But it was always fun to have. We booked both squash courts for 2 hours.
That's fun.
And you just played with, and it was a fun thing to do.
What is, I mean, I'm sure you've got a million, but what is the craziest thing you've ever seen in the vet industry?
The Doberman who ate a bed sheet.
An entire bed sheet?
Yes.
Oh my God.
I won't list his name because of client confidentiality, and this was like 26 years ago. So this dog is long dead just from whatever. Vomiting, couldn't figure out why, took an x-ray, couldn't really see anything, but clearly some stomach distension. So you do a barium x-ray where you feed them barium and then you take an x-ray every half hour and watch how it progresses through, and where it stops moving is where your obstruction is.
Right.
Left the stomach. So Dr. Beardall went in surgically, and it was like watching one of the magicians with the kerchiefs that come out his sleeve.
Oh my God.
Coming and coming and coming, and I'm like, what is that? It's like, it's a sheet from a twin bed.
Wow. Like,
okay, so you always show foreign bodies to the owners, and the owner went, oh, we'll have a 12-year-old son. I thought the fairy of good dreams came, so he just threw the sheet out. And the kid went, no, I spilled cup of soup on it and just put it in the laundry hamper because that's what you do with dirty stuff. And then mom washes the laundry. The dog had gone in the hamper and eaten the sheet.
Oh, no. The entire sheet.
I got it on the way down because that's not something you can swallow in one bite.
Yeah. Wow. So did he rip it up or did he like just...
One solid piece. There were chew marks and holes in it.
Ugh. How did he even swallow that?
I don't get, like, how did that thing go down your esophagus without tripping a vomit reflex to come back up?
That dog has no gag reflex.
I will never be surprised by what I hear gets removed from dogs' stomachs and intestines. Ever.
You idiot dog. You big dummy.
Most of the time it's the owner. Like, underwear is a big thing because people don't put their dirty stuff in the laundry hampers. They leave it on the floor. And it's clean underwear that your dog eats. It's always gross, dirty stuff.
That stinks.
have the debate, God, I hope this belongs to the people in the house and I'm not opening up something. Because we did remove a cherry red thong from someone's dog. We're like, please belong to your wife. Please.
A cherry red what?
Thong. Like women's underwear.
Oh, a thong.
I'm like, please, your wife. Because yeah. If it's not,
that's awkward.
A horrible mess for you.
Oh, those aren't mine. Great.
It was hers. Like, because you have to show the owner what you pulled out.
How embarrassing. That's hilarious.
Surprise me, though. Like, and if you take x-rays, we all play the game of, you can see the shape. What do you think it is?
That's fun. That'd be hilarious, though. You pull those out and you're like, hey, sir, your wife's a freak, huh?
Oh. Your nice fancy panties back yeah. If you want to wash them up.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Cats are much better.
My cats are strange for laying on things. Like, if it means he's off the hardwood floor, Murray will sit on anything that's sitting on the ground. So, like, if I have stuff sitting on the ground to take out to recycling, like a pizza box, he'll chill on the pizza box. Or if I have laundry folded on the ground, like, it'll be just, it's not even a pile, just one item, like a pair of shorts. He'll lay on the pair of shorts. And it'll be the smallest, like, they'll be folded in the smallest little square, and he'll lay on it, just so that his feet don't touch the floor. It's very, it's very strange. What's that?
Pipes is not that cool. Oh. She just wants her sweater bed.
Maria.
Which, owners, we, you know, don't spend $50 on a cat bed that they probably won't sleep in. We have an old sweater with a pillow in it.
Aw.
And she loves that thing. Bought it at Value Village for $3.99. I bought the cheapest pillow at Walmart that was, I think, $7. Made her a cat bed, and she loves it.
Yeah. Cats are strange creatures that way. You can get them a huge tower or whatever, and then they just play in the box. Little jerks.
Yeah, and she's got toys that we bought her that she never plays with, but if I drop a bread bag clip on the floor, man, hours of fun.
Tinfoil balls. Yeah. You just ball up a piece of tinfoil. I think it's because of the shininess of them, but if you've never tried this, grab a piece of tinfoil, ball it up, and just throw it in front of your cat and watch them freak out. It's great.
Oh, we try to do enrichment in the cages.
Mm-hmm.
Get bored. And you'll see things like a toilet paper roll.
Yeah.
Because flick it around and they'll have fun with it. Or just a piece of paper from the printer that somebody has balled up and tossed in there just to give them something to do. And they're quite happy with it. But then you go and you buy a bag of toys and they're like, I don't want those. Those are stupid.
I remember Terry, if you remember Terrence from the cafe, he was really neat because he was a feral cat and he had only been inside for a couple of weeks before he came to the cafe, and he had never seen toys before he came in. So it was neat watching him like learn how to play. Like, he was a young cat anyway, but watching him figure out like, oh, this is fun to play with was adorable. It was like watching kind of a baby grow up. It was neat.
Yeah. We think that's Pipe's basic problem because she's an adult feral and she came from an auto wrecker yard up on McAdoo's Lane area and ended up at the shelter. And it's like, you don't know how to play. I feel bad for you, but she doesn't like to socialize that much, so you can't really teach her to play.
Yeah.
She just prefers her activity of skulking around the edges of the rooms and glaring at stupid.
I experienced like mean cats when I was younger, but I never got the stereotype of cats being assholes. Like, all the cats that I've ever experienced, mind you, the ones that we had at the cafe were all social, like meant to be social, but I've never really met jerk cats. My cats are funny.
Jerk shell.
Pardon?
That's horrible. She said it was horrible because she had it before she had my brother and I.
Oh, yeah. So it's jealous.
Rivals, but she was mean to everybody but my mother. Like, you'd walk past her, she'd hiss, she'd smack you. We all had cuts on our ankles from that thing. And of course, it was 22 when it finally moved over the Rainbow Bridge.
Why do they call it that, by the way?
I don't know.
I remember
honestly have no idea. It's a nice little metaphor, but...
I guess. When I announced that I had put down Raja to all my regulars at the cafe, I put it online, and I started getting messages. And I had never heard that before, because I had never had a cat die. But people started saying, like, oh, he's moved over the Rainbow Bridge. And I was like, sure he has, you weirdo. Like, I didn't know that was a thing.
It is a poem, but I'm not sure if the poem came first or someone wrote a poem about the Rainbow Bridge. It's just one of those things we all say.
Hmm. It's very odd.
But at least Pipes is not a mean cat. She's just not particularly social on her terms. And she, of course, likes Brian the best, and he's not a cat person.
What's your favorite thing about working in the vet industry?
Kittens. I was in a litter of kittens for their 8-week vaccines, and they're so stinking cute.
Yeah, they're pretty cute. What is your biggest struggle then? Sorry, say that again.
I like the relationship you build with your clients. Mm-hmm. I'm lousy at people, so I will bump into clients, even now, and I haven't been in the clinic in 8 years, that I used to know. I'll bump into them at Walmart, and they're like, oh, hi, how you doing? We had to put Mindy down. Mindy. Oh, I remember Mindy.
Yeah.
Now I remember you, but I'm awful with people. But I love that if you work at a clinic long enough, you see them when they're babies, and then you're there for the geriatric visits too, and it's kind of nice to watch them grow up that way.
Yeah, that would be nice.
And you're part of the family with some of them, depending on what's wrong, especially your diabetic cats that are in all the time for their glucose curves and stuff. You build up a rapport with the people or with the cat's humans, and that's kind of nice.
Yeah, it would be, I imagine, a pretty difficult profession, because you're developing this relationship with this with these people, and if they continue coming to you, you see their pet grow old, and then you're there with them when they put it down. That's, you know, for a lot of people, that's one of the hardest points in their life, and but myself included.
Fatigue is a big thing.
For sure,
thing,
yeah.
And we now realize that it is a thing. Burnout.
Yeah.
You can't do your job anymore. You're burnt out. Well, you're not burnt out. You just have compassion fatigue.
Yeah.
Because it's a real thing. You get people who say, oh, your job must be great because you get to play puppies and kitties all day. They don't come to the back to see the technicians. They stay in the appointment room with the doctors and up with the receptionists. We come up to see them. The ones we're working with are sick.
Yeah. I remember talking to my friend about this long ago about how vet techs will see more trauma than ER nurses will in their entire career. I mean, you see more death and more like maimed animals regularly. I mean, you think about how many animals you'll put down in a month and how much death an ER nurse might see. It's minute by comparison. And
death is an option for us. If you come in by car and you're too injured, we can have the discussion about, do we really think that going ahead with treatment is in his best interest, or do you want us to end this? Right. Where in the car, that's not really something that we can talk about.
No, it's just treatment. So
yeah.
And to think that is any easier because it's an animal. I mean, you're just mistaken, because the people that work in this field, it's not because they're doing it for the money. We
love the animals. Don't get paid very well.
No, techs don't get paid very well, unfortunately, or assistants for that matter. But yeah. So back to belly dancing, let's wrap this up, and we'll give the details of this. So it's Spearhead Brewing Company. It's September 29th. You said?
Doors open at 6:30, to go on sale next week through eventbrite.ca.
Okay, and next week will be, what's the date today? The date today is the 10th.
Yes.
This will air on the 13th, I believe. It'll be on Monday, so this is Friday. It'll be on Monday, so next week, tickets will go on sale. Please continue. Yeah, it'll be the 13th.
Free preview, October, August 19th, we will be at Women's Art Fest on the stage at 1:30, and that is a free show.
Perfect. So YGK Women's Arts Fest, that's down in City Park?
Yeah.
Is that right?
City Park. In the Sir John A. McDonald Statue Park.
And you should come down to see that anyway. It's a smaller version of the YGK Art Fest. It's women artisans only. Dancers and art, jewelry makers and art creators and all these different things. Yeah.
They have a fantastic Facebook page where mm-hmm. they're promoting the different vendors that are going to be there. And there's some fantastic stuff coming yeah. in that even if you're not going to shop, it's great to go and look at it. You're out.
Well, and just to meet like local artisans that people you've never known, but they're all people. Well, mostly people from our community. Some people come from out of town for this, but most of the people that are here are from Kingston. So
there's a fantastic soap maker who will be there, who actually was my second belly dance instructor. Just belly dance plug there too.
Nice.
She now soaps and bar shampoos.
Mm-hmm.
A booth there, but they're looking at some of the artist stuff that they've been posting. There's just some beautiful things out there and some really talented people in our community. And it's a free day family.
Yeah, it's free to come out, bring some money if you want to purchase some art or some jewelry or some weavings or whatever. But otherwise, it's just a free day in the park. You get free entertainment. There's food vendors, I believe, as well. So it'd be good. That's August 19th in City Park.
We have performers on the stage, musicians, singers, us at 1:30.
And Jillian, if people want to get in touch with you, so how can they buy tickets? It's next week on Eventbrite, and the link will be where?
Spearhead will post the link on Spearhead their pages okay. through Instagram and Facebook.
Okay, or so just follow Spearhead.
And up and available.
Okay, so follow Spearhead on Facebook and Instagram for tickets. Jillian, if people want to get in touch with you, can they?
Yes, there is a Facebook page, Kingston Belly Dance Collective, that you can send a message to if you're interested in exploring more, if you maybe want to take classes or you just want more information or maybe you want to book some dancers for an event. We do some charity events, too. We're big with Dawn House a couple times a year. We do, it's called a hafla, which is the Arabic word for party.
Nice.
We put on a hafla twice a year that 100% of profits go to Dawn House. We did the Happy Tales Farm Sanctuary Be My Valentine last February.
That's
so awesome. It's a party that one of or more of us are interested in. You might be able to book us for that to help you out.
Wonderful.
And I'm also on Facebook as Jillian Cameron. You can message me directly if you want. Right now, it's a picture of my cat with a bunch of my belly dance gear because she was helping me sort costumes because she has a thing about the jingly janglies and the veils.
Of course, as they all will.
Not always appreciated. I actually was practicing Tuesday night, and there's a great big run in one of my silk veils. Who did that? And it wasn't me.
I have an idea.
Yeah.
All right, so
choreograph and have her on stage with me. It would be great, but she probably wouldn't cooperate.
She'd probably just sit on the edge and skulk.
Yeah, give me that Judgy Pipes look that she has. She makes choreography difficult because she sits on the couch and stares at me like, "Really? You think that looks nice? I don't think so."
That's typical, I think.
My worst critic or my best critic? I'm not sure.
Jillian Cameron, thank you for coming on. If people are looking for me, it's at Scott Fardella on Instagram or at Into the Void Podcast. Next week, we'll be back with Carrie Arthur, and Instagram, well, my a celebrity on Instagram. She's very popular. She's a tattoo artist. I'll be talking to her about all things tattooing. So tune in next week. Thank you, guys. Bye.
Thanks, Scott. Talk to you later.
Bye. As an addendum, on Friday, we recorded this episode. On Saturday night, I went to Spearhead because I had never heard of it before. So a buddy of mine and I went for a few drinks and rave reviews. It is awesome in there. So it's over on Development Drive, literally right beside Racks on the left-hand side. So get out there. It's fun. It's a cool little experience. We took a tour. Yeah, it's neat. They don't have a full kitchen, so they be prepared for that. But they have a few snacks, so give it a try.
Okay, see you next week. Bye.